Hi, everybody. My name's Carla Moore, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Bob for inviting me out here to share with you guys tonight. It is an honor and a privilege to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, anything. And my whole life is built on Alcoholics Anonymous. When I'm happy, when I'm sad, when things are going my way, when they're not, I am in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, for 19 years and a couple weeks now. And I never did anything for 19 years in a row on purpose that was of any value before I got here. So I'm really glad to be here and love taking road trips. I've always been a gypsy at heart, more like a hobo in the old days, but I just like to go. I like to go home now, though, too. And so I'm glad to be here, and I want to thank Stephanie for her coat. I'm not sure if I'm going to be hot or cold up here, but I can change my mind. Anyway, when I got here, I would have told you that I'm an alcoholic because of the crazy, dark, dramatic, violent, sometimes perverted family that I had. If you had my family, you'd drink too. Yeah, and I spent a lot of years on that one. I mean, just a lot of years. And I've been in AA long enough now to see that a lot of people I know that lived charmed childhoods, and they are as alcoholic as I am. And a lot of people went through the exact same thing I went through and worse, and never, alcohol doesn't do for them what it does for me. And it took a long time for me to see that. And I found refuge in school and things like that for a while. And I don't want you to think it was all bad. You know, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade were awesome. I had a good time in elementary school. And then it changed. You know, I had some good years, and then about 12, I peaked, I think. And that summer between junior high and elementary school, you know, I got my first social resentment. And I am really one of those people who did not get the manual. I did not feel like you guys looked. And I got my first social resentment after a game of Spin the Bottle. I was at my friend's house. We were playing a game of Spin the Bottle and sharing a bottle of his dad's whiskey. And passing that around, and the bottle that we spun landed on me, and I went off into the bedroom with one of the boys, and we both came back out after doing the same thing. I mean, we were both there, right? But they called him a player and me a slut, and I did not think that was fair. And I will die on the hill if it's not fair. You know, I do not know how to accept the things that I can't change. And I just, my pride got hurt. I got a reputation I didn't understand, nor could I take responsibility for. And life started to get dark. And that's when alcohol really started to work for me. Those weren't my first drinks, but those were the drinks that I started to use to get to where I needed to be even. And when my pride kicks in, I withdraw from life. I started to back away, and I started spending more time in the girls' room than I did in the classroom. And just lost hope now. School had been my last refuge, or one of my last refuges, and that wasn't working anymore either. So I started to find my hope out on the open road, and I love that feeling. I just love to get out on that on-ramp going on the, well, in California, it's the 10 going east away, and the 101 freeway going north, and I just love that feeling. I love to get in the car or the truck going wherever with whoever, and I'd be on my way to somewhere else. And I never made any big plans about what I was going to do when I got there. I just went, and that put me in a lot of funny positions. Not funny, ha-ha, funny, odd. And I started spending a little time in juvenile hall, you know, a week and a week. I wasn't a big criminal. I was more of a nuisance, really. And when I was 14, I found myself in a place called North Beach in the San Francisco area, where a couple of guys propositioned my friend and I down on Kearney Street, and we did the next indicated thing, and boom, a whole new career path opened up for us. And I never developed any particular marketing strategy as far as that went, but if Heidi Fleiss was the Neiman Marcus of the profession, I was more like the 99-cent store, really. I started living a day at a time in a way I've not had to live in a very, very long time. And it just seemed like it made sense. You know, the outside started to match the insides. And I was willing to trade it away for the next feel better. I was willing to trade it all, bit by bit by bit. My friend Rachel says we sell ourselves away a nickel at a time, and that's exactly what I did. And I was willing to go to any lengths to serve that master. And I try to go back home and live with mom and live with dad and reintegrate myself back in the community. You know, I'm going to get it right this time. And, you know, I'd go back to school and it would just, those feelings of difference had increased. You know, I'd go out on the road and I'd come back and I felt so much more different than you. And I certainly wasn't going to tell you where I'd been. I'm talking about mom stuff now. And she's, she had a lot of trouble for a while and now her life has gotten really good. And my father doesn't have to sit up nights anymore watching the news to make sure his daughter's name isn't on the list of the victims of the serial killers of the day. You know, he sleeps well, and he knows it's because of you. He doesn't have to get it. He doesn't completely understand it. It's only important that I understand. But he's real glad that I'm here. And a couple of years before I got sober, my baby sister committed suicide. She was 17 years old, and it took her all weekend to die. And we were all at the hospital, my mom, my stepfather, and me and my some other members of the family. And I would leave the waiting room, and I'd go out to the car, and I'd drink, and then I'd come back into the waiting room, and I'd rake my mother across the coals. You know, I just tore her up and blamed her while her baby lay dying in the next room. And I don't know how you make amends for that, really, except to call, I was told to call her once a week and try to figure out how I could add to her life in some way, all the time. Think about her as much as I could and try to add to her life. And over time I did that, and I know this is going to make you real sick if you're new. It did me. I didn't think I wanted it. But, you know, over time my relationship with my mother changed. And she was somebody, even though I knew I had a big part in the hurt that I had caused her, I couldn't get past her hurt. It took me a long, long time. And it was just, again, that little by little by little, taking actions I didn't believe in and calling her, and now I call her a lot. I love my mom. I love her in my life. And you guys have given me a gift. You've changed me, so much so that 4 years ago when my baby brother died of this disease, he was 30 years old, 6'10", 160 pounds, when he lay in the hospital on life support, little pinholes in his heart from doing the crank, and he wasn't going to stop drinking because he didn't have a problem. When they took him off life support, mercifully, he died. And when he did, I got to go up and be the kind of a daughter that my mother needed while she barely had a second child. And I don't know what kind of pain that is, really, but I know that this time, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to go up and be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. I'll just tell you a little bit about me now. You know, there's a promise in the Big Book that says that in God's hands, our dark past will become our greatest asset. And I really believe that, and I've begun to experience that now. You know, about a year and a half ago, I began to take ballroom dancing lessons. The elegance of it all, I never would have thought, you know. And a few months into that, my dance teacher's trying to teach me to rumba, you know. And I don't know about you, but when I started to change in Alcoholics Anonymous and I came here, I didn't want to do anything that I had done before. You know, I had tucked all that sexy stuff in, and I wasn't going to, you know, be inappropriate in any way. And so now my dance teacher wants me to do the rumba, you know, and that, you got to get a little wiggle on, right, you know, to do that dance. And I, you know, I was having trouble coming up with that. And finally he got frustrated and he said, you know, Carla, do not try to dance like a good girl. I don't think they will believe you anyway. So my dark past has been woven into this huge tapestry that is my life. You know, it's here for you to see if you need it. And yet I belong in the outside world. I have a big life. I have a big, big life. And not only am I loved, but I get to feel love, experience love for other people. And I've just never had it so good. And it's thanks to you. I hope if you're new that you stay. Thank you. On my summer vacation, that's for sure. And when I was 15, I found myself being admitted to a mental hospital. The courts just took over, and I was supposed to be there for 2 weeks, and I ended up being there for a year. I just sort of moved in, made myself at home, and they weren't talking to me a lot about alcoholism back then. They were talking to me about disorders. I was a very disordered-looking 15-year-old. They were giving me daily nutritional supplements, of Thorazine, Melaril, Valium, Dalmane sleepers. I guess they were worried I wouldn't sleep. I became intimately familiar with five-point restraints. I was just restless, irritable, and discontent is what I know today. But back then, they were calling it disorders. And I was just crazy. I went crazy. And I lived with a level of frustration I can hardly even recall now. I haven't experienced that in a very long time. But back then, I just couldn't accept life on life's terms. And living in my skin was out of the question. if you don't want to go crazy in the nut house, you better get busy, and that's what I did. And one of my favorite ways to get busy was boys. You know, I've just always been fascinated with them, and fascinated and frightened all at the same time, really. And always reaching from the outside to try to fix the inside, always. And my favorite boys, I loved all of them, but my favorites were those sexy, smoldering types, you know, the kind that were just getting ready to blow any second now, you know. And you just never knew when they were going to really pop. And today I know that feeling as fear, but... But I liked them back then. And the trouble with that is you're always having to say goodbye to the guys like that in the nut house. You know, they're always doing something stupid to get hauled off to YA. They're on to the next, you know, because it's progressive, too. And I remember sitting out on the smoke break bench, you know, watching my boyfriend Terry being cuffed and escorted out by security. And I don't know about you, but I've always thought I should have a soundtrack to my life, you know, music playing in the background of all this drama going on. And I remember sitting out on the smoke break bench and watching him, and I was playing Diana Ross at top decibel, you know, touch me in the morning, then just walk away. Oh, it's tragic, you know, just tragic. It hurts so good, you know, that all goes on between my ears, you know, that I was brokenhearted and blue before I ever had a real date. But there's always another boyfriend coming along in the nut house, you know? You don't have to wait for long. I went from the girls' unit to the co-ed unit to the intensive care unit. And I know today is supposed to be the other way around, but I didn't get it. There were a lot of well-meaning people trying to give me the key and the answers to how to live on the outside. And I wasn't listening. I didn't pay attention. I didn't care. When I wanted to go out on the outside, I found my way under the gate or out the front door with my clothes on under my pajamas when we'd go on to parent group or over the fence or something. And I'd go out, and the mental hospital was my home. So when I was done on the outside, I'd come right back in the front door, sometimes by way of juvenile hall again, but the mental hospital was my home. And so I'd go out for a little vacation and then come back in. And they also told me that I was going to have to learn how to relate to boys on something other than a horizontal basis. And I didn't like that either. I didn't, you know, always looking, you know, I mistake love for, or sex for love, and brute strength for strength of character, and arrogance for confidence. You know, I'm just always missing the mark. Just, and reaching from the outside. As soon as I get it in my hot little hand, you know, it turns to dust. It's just not real. You know, it just so different. I met the love of my life on the intensive care unit. He was kicking heroin in 17 days. 17 days he was cured. And I went over the wall for the last time with him. And he was 22. I was 16. I was coming off Thorazine. He introduced me to cocaine. And woohoo, I think it was just too much of a contrast for him. Oddly enough, my probation officer knew exactly where to find me 2 weeks later. It hurt my feelings to realize that I think he called her. She's right here. Come get her. So back in the nut house and in lockup, you know, and it never occurred to me that my alcoholism was that I had alcoholism back then in the first place, and or that any of the stuff I was doing was keeping me there. You know, I'd go out and I'd do the very same things that got me locked up in the first place, and I didn't have much time on the outside as it was. And I went through that rehab and then into a girl's home and locked up. You know, I mean, I really kind of fancied myself more of a political prisoner, really. That's the way I saw it. And it's going to be better when I turn 18. They're not going to be able to tell me what to do. And that didn't happen either. And from the girl's home, I met my roommate. And, you know, we were on a spiritual quest. We were eating a lot of LSD and drinking and reading Baba Ram Dass, trying to figure out what be here now meant exactly. Trying to remember our zip code. And so I've always been in love with the idea of what I thought the 60s were, you know, what they might have been. Because I was 12 in 1969, so they were over by the time I got out in the world. And always a day late and a dollar short. But, you know, I was in there pitching and... And everything that I thought that I loved about that, everybody told me was in Oregon. So we thought we'd go to Oregon. God might be there. And so we went up to Eugene, Oregon. And, you know, it was sort of true. I mean, the Grateful Dead was in the air, and they were up there a lot. And there was a lot of that kind of stuff going on, organic, you know, hippie stuff. And I thought my life was going to change from the outside in. You know, I moved in with my girlfriend and her boyfriend, and we planted a little garden in the front yard. And, you know, when they talk about hoeing up there, they mean with a garden tool. So I was pretty sure it was going to get different from the outside in. But two things happened when I was up there. One, if I wasn't going to do the things that I've been doing to make a living, then I didn't always have the money I needed, and I wasn't always able to drink the way that I needed to drink. And without a drink or some kind of sober solution, I am restless, irritable, and discontent, and very, very hard to get along with. And then the other thing that happened was when I could drink the way that I needed to drink, I am always overshooting the mark. And even back then, I didn't know that. I just thought I was enjoying it. You know, one drink seemed to need another, and that's how it went. And I couldn't predict even back then if I was going to have 2 or 22. And sooner or later, if you're sleeping on your friend's couches like I was, they're going to come to you and say something like, "Carla, we really love you, but you got to go." And that was to happen a lot. And I wound up back down in my dad's house for a little while. I was 17 and a half years old, and I couldn't get off his couch. I sat on his couch in his den, and I just sat there. And I was afraid. I didn't know how to tell him. I didn't know how to go out in the world and make a living. I didn't know how to tell him. I didn't know where the last few years of my life had gone. I sat on his couch and I drank his booze. And he had this wonderful shrine of a liquor cabinet in his den. You know, he didn't drink a drop. He was scared to death of this stuff. And so I just figured it was there for me. You know, it was just five shelves high and seven bottles deep, and I drank it. And right before my 18th birthday, my father came to me and he said what I know were the hardest words he ever had to say to his oldest daughter, and that is, "I'm not going to watch you die and I'm not going to help you do it. You got to go." And I knew that day was coming too. And all I could think of on my way out the door was that one of the counselors at the rehab had told me I was a great actress. And I know today I'm misunderstood, but I ended up on Hollywood Boulevard, and there's not a lot of auditioning going on out there, just so you know. And I was starting my days off with a pint of Popov vodka, and I would go wherever the day took me. And some days we called it a party, and some days it was surviving. It was just one gray day after another, and not a lot of hope about it getting any different. It just, you know, you just take it and like it. And a few months into that, I met a man walking down Hollywood Boulevard, and I saw the light in his eyes, and I didn't know it was warm sunshine, but we hit it off, and I moved in with him that night, and I didn't even know his last name, and I lived there for 6 weeks, and then he's asking me to leave, rather firmly asking me to leave, and I still didn't know his last name. And I just like to bring him up because years and years later, he was on my eight-step list in my first year of sobriety. He was somebody who came up very, very clearly. He had been nothing but kind to me, and all I had done was been that proverbial tornado way back then at 18 years old and just run through his life and run through his house and tore everything up and just, you know, very, very bad, bad memories. And I couldn't find him. You know, I just didn't know how to find him. And I had gone everywhere I knew to look. And so my sponsor just told me that I was going to have to stand willing. And in the meantime, there are probably some things I could change about my behavior in the meantime to ready myself for that. And like I could try to be a friend to a man in a vertical fashion. I could start there. And I did. You know, I learned how to practice these principles. I have a lot of friends of both genders these days, you know, and I know how to do that. Right before my 13th AA birthday, I had to go give a talk on the other side of town, and it was a day I didn't feel like going. It was a hot Sunday afternoon, and thank God you guys have taught me that it's what I do and not how I feel that matters. And I went out and I gave that talk, and of course I kept my commitment and I felt better. And when the talk was over, the thank you line came through, and in that thank you line, this man stopped about halfway through and he said, "Hey, where were you in 1976? And it was a guy from Hollywood Boulevard, and he was standing there in front of me with 8.5 years of sobriety and I with almost 13. And it occurred to me a long time after that had I found him when I was looking for him, he wouldn't have been sober, and maybe he might not have got it. I don't know, but he got, you know, it happened when it was supposed to happen. My creator has a huge sense of timing. And I got to make those direct amends to him, you know, and at the end of it all, he said, "Oh my God, Carla, it's long forgiven, long forgotten. I just can't believe you're still alive." You know, and it's true. If we're in this room tonight, we're the lucky ones. You know, I don't know what we did or anything, but walk through the doors and sit in the chairs and shake a couple hands. I mean, how lucky are we? And if you're new, you can start tonight. Tonight can be your sobriety date. And if you're around and you're suffering a little bit with some time, maybe 11 or 15 or I don't know, there's something, you know, I've had to start over a few times in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't have to drink to do it. I just did it. You know, I hope you stay. And that was a long time to come. And at the end of that year, I left Hollywood and I met another man from another rehab and we hooked up. And, you know, again, flying on the coattails of the 60s, just loving the idea of what peace and love and all of that stuff might have been. And it's just that we couldn't stop knocking the hell out of each other really long enough to fully implement the principles of peace and love. And so we beat each other up and down the California coast, and we pitched a tent in the mountains in southern Oregon, and moved into up in the world a little bit to a roofless cabin, and we threw a plastic tarp over the top of that and called it a skylight, and lived there till the baby came. And we had this little girl, and I thought that she was going to save me. You know, I thought that taking care of her was going to be, you know, I loved her enough. If I just loved her enough, that it was going to get different. And there were many, many, many times that I ended up walking the streets of Grants Pass with her in my backpack, you know, and I had another little habit going too, and she was on my back, and I just remember walking in the rain looking for a place to stay, and so she didn't stop it either, you know, loving her didn't stop my alcoholism. And when she was about 10 months old, she got in the way of one of our fights, and I took her up to Idaho where it's got to be better. You know, it's just got to be better somewhere else. It's going to be better up there, over there. And I took her up there, and I had three jobs up in Idaho working cocktail waitressing and tending bar. And any normal person could have made a good living doing what I was doing. And I still couldn't bring home enough money to pay rent for more than a week at a time. So we lived in the rent-by-the-week motels up there. And I just drug her from one place to the next. And my kid was one of those kids that you see by now that has her T-shirt and underwear and yesterday's lunch going on the front of it because her mom's not paying attention. And that's how we lived until after a while, of course. Idaho's not working for us anymore either. And I've been drinking straight scotch, you know, just stick to the scotch. Don't put the bubbles in there. That'll give you a hell of a hangover, you know, just scotch. And so that wasn't working either, and we're back down in L.A., and I'm renting a room for my aunt in Covina, and I'm working in a bar in Hollywood, another bar, and I'm making good money out there. Still, not a shameful place to work, great place. And my daughter was almost 4 years old by then, and every afternoon I'd leave our place, and I'd kiss her goodbye, and I'd take off for the bar in Hollywood, and I'd stop at the halfway point, which was a bar called the First Cabin in Arcadia, and I'd stop there, and I'd have my primer drinks, you know, the drinks to get me ready to get up and go do my shift in Hollywood, and my favorites back then were shots of Cuervo Gold and Bud Bax, and I'd have a few of those and get up off the bar stool, go out there and do my shift and pour drinks and drink with everybody till the wee hours of the morning and crawl back home and start all over again. And one afternoon I kissed my daughter goodbye as I had done over and over and over, and I stopped at that same bar in Arcadia and had those same shots of Gold and same Bud Bax, and something was different that afternoon. You know, I just progressed one more inch, one more degree down the line. And I didn't hate that job in Hollywood, and I didn't love my daughter any less on that day than I love her today, but I could not get off the bar stool, couldn't suspend my drinking long enough to get up and go take care of business on either side. And so I sat on the bar stool and I drank through them both. I lost them both in one fell swoop, and it didn't stop me from drinking. It just wasn't enough. Alcohol had become my master. And I would sit there in that bar at night, and I'd hear the band playing about midnight, you know, and my gut would wrench and my throat would close. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt you could walk my daughter up to me and say, look, if you'll stop drinking, you can have her back. I knew it wasn't going to happen. I just knew it wasn't going to happen. And I stopped calling after a while. I stopped calling to see how she was doing, because then I had to answer those hard questions like, Mommy, when are you coming to get me? And, you know, it was just much too hard on me. And so I stopped calling, and I lived off the kindness of strangers there for a little while until I fell into another job in another dive bar. And now the bars I'm working in are becoming increasingly rustic, as are the people. And I thought getting married might be the answer. You know, I met the man who would become my husband there, and it seemed like a good idea at the time. We got married about the time we should have split up, and I was a little cozy little place just off Highway 15 coming up here. It used to be called the Outpost Wedding Chapel. It's just on the other side of Shed World. Some of you might know it. Shed World's still there. We became an active household. You know, I just thought if I made my life look like I thought yours was on the outside, something would happen, you know, it would be different. And we just became an active household. I threw the first punch in that relationship. I just know how it's supposed to go. We bought ourselves a big gun to protect ourselves from the night stalker. And the only people we turned that gun on was each other. I just tried to get to it first. We got the daughter back by hook or crook after about 2.5, 3 years, and I don't know if that was good or bad, but we did. And my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous was after one of our fights. We were at the bar where we drank, and we were fighting over whether or not I should get off the bar stool. Now, there's a reason, you know, there's a big reason to fight. And I lost that fight, and I ended up with some black eyes and broken ribs and not a lot of people feeling sorry for me, just glad I was leaving. And he picked me up, and he took me to the hospital that afternoon, and I got all fixed up, and he took me home. And he had to leave for work that weekend, so before he left, he left me with a giant ice chest full of beer and a bottle of Beefeater gin. And now I'm drinking gin because, well, tequila had been making me really mean. You understand, right? And I started drinking that gin, and I started calling people, drinking and dialing. And I don't know all of who I called, but I know I felt like a battered woman, so I called a battered woman shelter. And I asked the woman who answered the phone to fix my life. And she asked me if I'd ever been to an AA meeting. I don't know how she made that leap, but she did. And I found an AA meeting that night not far away from where I lived, and I went in there, and two very kind women sat me down and gave me the newcomer packet, you know, a cup of coffee and a tissue. And, I was feeling very sorry for myself and not looking very pretty either. And a woman was talking that night, and you know, I can sit here and talk all night to you guys, and the one thing I cannot make you is ready. I just can't give that to you. It just seems like we all have to come to that on our own, and I was not ready that night. I sat and I listened to that woman talk, and I heard her say that somewhere during her drinking career she switched to beer, so I did. I left that meeting that night thinking, hey, I'll tell you, switch to beer. Good idea. And for a long time, you know, it gave me the illusion that I was controlling my drinking. You know, it was soothing to my body. The hard stuff had just ravaged me. And so, it seemed like I was controlling it. And I came to with a beer, and I passed out with a beer. And I just lived around that for a couple of years. And we got evicted from that little apartment we lived in, and we ended up living in a little room in his ex-wife's backyard, and none of us liked that very much. And I got a little job answering phones. I thought, you know, geez, yeah, I got a little alcoholic willpower together, I guess. You know, I had that in other regards, just not drinking. And I started answering phones for the city, and we moved into a little apartment across town for one more hideous, tedious, violent year. And just more of the same, more of the same. And till finally one Saturday afternoon, you know, the cops are in the driveway one more time. The neighbors are peeking out the window wondering what's going on at Charlie and Carla's house one more time. And my kid's now 10 years old, and she's standing over in the corner looking over at me. I'm looking at everybody else. And my husband left for the last time, and the cops left, and they took the gun, and everybody was gone. It was me and the kid, and we're sitting in this little apartment, and I saw everywhere I'd ever been all coming back to me. You know, I knew she wasn't going to be there for long. I knew that we weren't going to be living indoors for very much longer. And I mean, by then I weighed 110 pounds. I'm almost 6 feet tall, and I weighed 110 pounds, and I had that puffy, skinny, fat face, you know, sunken eyes and distended liver, and I looked like a beach ball on stilts, and I felt like if you blew on me, I'd turn to dust, really. I was real tired, but it was still my only solution. It was still the best solution I had. And I saw it all coming back, and I was no longer welcome in the bars where I had drank. I was drinking at home, and it was just trouble. I was just more trouble than I was worth. And my first sponsor told me if I wanted to effect a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, that I could start by counting the coincidences that happened in my life. And one of the first ones I could count was that I had moved in next door to a woman who had 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had seen and heard the whole fight go down, you know, and a couple days later she knocked on my door, and she brought me a big book and a 12 and 12, and she came in and she sat on my couch and she told me her story. And in her story, I could tell that she used to drink like me. And over the last year, I had seen with my own eyes that she wasn't drinking anymore. And what impressed me more about that was that it didn't seem to bother her that she wasn't drinking. And see, that gets me, because, you know, not drinking without some kind of sober solution, some steps, a God, a fellowship, something. I feel like you've stripped all the coating off my wires. You know, I feel oversensitive and underloved. I don't know what you meant by that or why you looked at me that way. And my life closes in on me from there, you know. And sooner or later, I got to come back around. The only solution I see, even with all the trouble that it causes, is that first drink. And then that's the drink that takes me away. And I didn't know that then. I didn't care. But while she was talking, you know, I went back to the day. The last time I had been without a drink, I had been in the nut house, you know, and they were giving me a lot of stuff. you know, Thorazine, Malaril, that's heavy stuff. And I didn't know if these 12 steps were going to be quite big enough to carry somebody as especially crazy as I was. And I'm happy to report 19 years later that they have been absolutely as big as they've needed to be. But back then, it was the reservation I held. And I listened to her talk. And as she left my apartment that afternoon, she turned to me and she asked me if I had trouble accepting life on life's terms. And I said, absolutely not. Life sucks. And I fully get that. Fully. And I didn't get sober that afternoon. It was a week or so later. One Sunday afternoon again, I just didn't go back and buy any more beer. And exactly what I thought was going to happen happened. I started to shake, and I started to get sick into the night, and I started hearing things and seeing things that weren't there, and shaking into Monday and shaking into Tuesday. And by Tuesday afternoon, I did something different than I had done before, and I went back to my neighbor instead of the store. And I asked her what to do then, and she sent me up to a meeting up in Sierra Madre, and that became my first home group. I went up there that night, and I sat in the back by the exit sign just in case what, I don't know, but just in case. And I wasn't sure that this wasn't going to be just some kind of bad Tony Robbins motivational speaker thing, you know. I didn't know. But I heard a lot of hope in that room that night. I heard that people were talking about how they used to drink, and that got me, you know, and how they felt. And I heard some of that. And at the very end of that meeting that night, the secretary did something very nice for me, and she walked straight back to me with that portion of A Vision for You that we read at the end of a lot of meetings, and she asked me to read. And I'm so glad I didn't jump up out of my chair and leave or say no or something. She handed it to me, and I said yes, and I read. And if you ask me all these years later, yes is still the answer. You know, it keeps me in the rooms. It keeps me in a posture of hearing the message. Every time I say yes, I'm setting up chairs or pouring coffee or giving a newcomer a ride or giving anybody a ride or getting a cup of coffee or being in here. Even when my spirit and my head, nothing can catch up, my feet are in here and I'm in a posture of hearing the message. I didn't know that back then, but that's what happened. I stayed sober for 89 days, and then that edge came back a little bit, and I thought a big book and a beer sounded more like balance. But you guys had ruined my drinking, and I only had to stay out a day, and thank God I got back. Not everybody does, and I've heard a lot of horror stories. I was lucky enough to come back, and I haven't had a drink since. And they gave me commitments at all my meetings, and God, I love those commitments. You know, like I just said, they just keep me in the rooms. And my favorite commitment was the coffee commitment, because I got out of work at 5 o'clock, and at 5:05 I was in the meeting, even though the meeting didn't start till 8. You know, I was in the grocery store buying stir sticks and coffee and creamer and trying to figure out what kind of cake and cards and whose birthday is it. And, you know, when I got here, I didn't understand what self-centeredness meant. You'd say, you got to get out of yourself. And I couldn't get my head around it. I didn't even know what that means. Is it on me now? Am I doing it? What is that? I don't know. But it was the absence. You know, every time I did something else and I wasn't thinking about me for just a little while, you know, I'd have the absence from the noise of the inside of my own head. And I wanted more of that. You know, that was peace of mind. And then I saw later in the big book, it said, you know, our very lives depend on the constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. And you guys gave me those jobs, you know. And then the really great thing was when I had to come in and make coffee, you guys got there early, and I was there early, and I didn't know what to do with you. I mean, I stayed very busy making coffee. Until I could learn to talk to you, and I had to. They told me if I don't grow, I go. And those 10-minute coffee breaks began to feel like 2 hours long, you know. And I had to jump in and start shaking your hands. And I didn't like that idea really. Well, I like the idea. I just like the actual doing it. But I learned how, you know. I had to. I knew my life. I knew if I left that meeting that night, that I might not come back. And a lot of my growth in Alcoholics Anonymous has come from that kind of desperation, where it's just where I actually have to do something different than I really want to. And I started, and I love you guys. I really love you. I mean, we're bodily and mentally different from a lot of people, but we're not bodily and mentally different from each other. And I you know, here's where we gather. Aren't we lucky? And I started taking the steps with my sponsor. And my sponsor was she was a very kind old woman. Her story wasn't similar to mine, except that she drank like I did, you know. But she wasn't out running around. She sat on her couch and she drank in her dirty old nightie, she said, you know. But she drank. I'd get out of our meeting like at 9:30 or 10, and I'd get home like 20 minutes later, and I'd call her. And she didn't say, "God damn it, why are you calling me at this hour?" She'd say, "Boy, you're going to get this thing, aren't you?" And yeah, I was. You know, I needed to hang on to her. She was my lifeline for a while. So now when I get those 10:30 calls and those 11 o'clock calls, I can't say, "God damn it, why are you calling me at this hour?" I took the steps and I made that first round of amends to my family and the people around me, work and people I could find. And I owed the most to my family. I had broken their hearts consistently on a daily basis for years and years and years, and they were the ones I had to face first. And that was just not, that mere mumbling of "I was wrong and I promise I won't do it again." It was like actually not doing it again. Women started asking me to sponsor them, then the light started to come on. The light started to come on in them, and it started to come on in me more, and I felt a part of this thing. After a couple of years, though, I had had you guys, and I was putting food on the table, and we were paying rent for more than a month in a row and all that kind of stuff, but I had had you guys, and my daughter didn't have anybody, really. So she was 12 years old, and she started to come home beat up and bloody at all hours of the night. And she'd been jumped into a gang. And what I didn't know at the time was that she had been, was trying to find her sense of camaraderie and family out in the street. You know, she was, because I was busy being wonderful in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was in 2 and 3 meetings a day and going to work. And it was where I felt safe, and I probably up till that time needed every single meeting I'd been in. But now it was time to change that. It was time to, now please, I am not saying do not go to meetings. But on page 19 in the book, it says that a more important demonstration of our principles happens in our homes and respective workplaces. And that if I'm not doing it out there, I'm only half doing it. And that's what I started to have to learn. And I had to take it into my home. And I didn't know what to do with this 12-year-old kid. I mean, you got to talk to her and stuff. And I didn't, you know, and she was one pissed off little kid. And I had to find a treatment center for her. We found a treatment center, and it was my job to go show up, you know. And that's where I learned about making amends in the dark, you know. I didn't know if I was going to have a relationship with her ever again. And I still, it was for me to stand up in the morning, get up in the morning, go do the best I could, go show up for her, be what she needed me to be, and not expect anything. After 6 months, things had gotten better, but they weren't perfect, you know. Nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous or any other time has happened overnight for me, you know. It's you guys taught me that a penny adds up to a dollar and a day adds up to a year, and mountains are moved a spoonful at a time. You guys taught me that, and how to live in the middle, you know, how to live on my way, and how to take little actions. And she wanted to go live with her dad after she got out for a while, and I had to get out of the way and let her go do that. And lo and behold, years later, she's got a relationship with her father and one with me, and it worked out fine that way. And while she was gone, I stayed busy in AA, you know, and I was getting better jobs and working at a firm downtown, and I had insurance, a driver's license, and registration all at the same time. You know, that kind of thing is big for us, you know. I turned 5 years sober, and that's when they, you know, they were saying, "Oh, then you're really sober," and I don't know what that meant, but I came home from the gym one night and took my shower as usual and went to bed and woke up in the middle of the night to a man standing over my bed with a knife to my neck and his hand over my mouth, and he said, "Don't say a word or I'll cut your head off," and he took the telephone cord and he tied my hands behind my back and he raped me and he robbed me that night in my bed, in my house. He came in through the kitchen window. And at 5 years of sobriety, I had a God. You know, I'd come here with all kinds of cockamamie ideas about what God might be. And, you know, I'd looked into it. I mean, I've always been on that search. There was just, you know, it always been on that search. And a lady named Susan simplified that for me when I got here. She said, "Why don't you just call him God and let him get as big as he needs to be in your life?" And that helped. You know, I had the trouble God when I first got here. And I needed that trouble God. And I had a lot of troubles. And then I got the parking space God, and I like that God. I learned how to take no for an answer with a parking space God. "You want to park here, get here early," is what I learned. And that's what I learned. I'm responsible for my own. And then somewhere along the line, I realized that I'm never going to be able to describe God. I'm never going to have. If I could, then I'd be God. So, I've just learned how to appreciate the mystery a little more, you know. And I had, at 5 years of sobriety, some sense that things were going to turn out the way they were supposed to. And you guys gave me that, you know. The second step asked me to choose to believe that God's everything or is nothing. And I got nothing to lose by choosing to believe he's everything. And he left a few hours later. He went out the same window he came in, and it turned out that I had known him. I'd actually watched him get sober 30 days before I did. I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids, and everything back. And then I watched him join the church and leave AA behind. And when he went out like that. And what I choose to believe from that, or what I think I've learned from that, is that while the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right, this is a place where I learned that I am not one of those people who can go home after a Sunday sermon and have a glass of wine with everybody else. This is a place where I learned that. This is a place where I learned the terms and conditions of my disease. And then I can go practice that 11th step anywhere I want to. Anywhere. Different place every day or nowhere. This has been enough for me. But my sponsor told me I was going to have to forgive this guy. And I know she's right. I know at 5 years of sobriety, I'm someone who can't handle even seemingly justifiable resentments. You know, I just can't. But the guy had scared me, you know. Every time my car door would slam, I'd jump and I'd get mad, you know. And anger was still my favorite place to go. When I get scared, I like anger, you know. It just makes me feel focused, you know, like I got a purpose. And you can't hurt me, really. But at 5 years of sobriety, it's like a suit that doesn't fit anymore. You know, I can't be angry and I can't not be angry. And I know it's killing me and I don't know how to let go. And those 6 and 7 steps, I mean, this is what separates the men from the boys. This is where I had to change. And I didn't know what I was supposed to look like on the other side. I had no idea. So I just said those prayers, you know. Said that 7-step prayer and asked God to keep me willing to be willing. And I didn't know what it was going to be. And I got up and went to work every morning. And that was my demonstration of faith, was just to get up and go to work every morning, even when I didn't feel like going. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous swooped in around me, you know, my home group, and I'd start to feel a little sorry for myself, you know, in a little kind of tainted way. You know, I'd say, well, maybe a girl like me is bound to have something like that happen every now and then, you know. And they'd say, no, maybe you just got in the way of somebody not doing God's will, you know, and maybe it wasn't about you at all. Maybe he needed to go back to AA and he'll get some meetings in H&I. Maybe, you know, maybe. But it's none of my business. There was a trial that followed, and they found him a couple weeks later, and there was a trial. And as part of the defense, he had a lot of the guys I had known in the bars the years before come up and testify as to who I used to be. And a lot of the things they said were true, and some of them weren't. My ex-husband was more than happy to raise his hand and testify, and I couldn't blame him. I mean, again, you know, that tornado, that proverbial tornado going through somebody's life, and then I had to get a character witness come and testify on my behalf. And so I was working at an investment firm downtown LA. You know, it's a place where I never even would have walked in the front doors of years before. I never would have had any business being there. And now I'm working there. And the division head has volunteered to come in and testify on my behalf. You know, some people just know the right thing to do intuitively. And they told him all about who I used to be. And he said, you know, she shows up early and she stays late. And she was where she said she was. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. He didn't have to be coached. He just got up and he told the truth as he had experienced it through me. Then it was my turn to testify, and I got up there on the witness stand, and I looked out and I saw him sitting out there at the defense table, and it's a place where I sat, and I could sit again. If I were to go out, it might not be rape, but it could be something equally as destructive. And it started to occur to me that what stood between us at the time, maybe a few more things, but what's the basic that stood between us was a drink. And if I were to go out and drink, you know, who knows? And so it became two alcoholics sitting on opposite sides of the courtroom that started to happen. It was just sort of that leveled the playing field for me. It opened up the chink in the armor that I needed to, so I could start to let this thing go. And, you know, angels didn't come out of the sky and sing hallelujah, and I wasn't done with it and just walked out free of the resentment and the fear. You know, it took about a year and a half for those nightmares to go away. You know, little by little, little is what you guys taught me. Get up, whether I feel like it or not. Go make the coffee. Go to work. The detective who worked the case came to me after it was over, and he said, you know, I don't know who you were back then. I'm not even sure I want to know, but whatever it is you're doing now, keep doing it, because it seems to be working. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. He got 20, and he did 13, and And I don't know, I don't know how it was. I don't know how he is now. But when he was getting out, Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous again swooped in around me, and they made sure that I knew I was going to be safe until I could again rely on that power greater than myself that I can't always see. You know, sometimes that God speaks through people. My friend Don Newcomb says it like this. He says, when I need help, I come to you, and then you send me to pray. When I pray, then God sends me one of you, and it just works that way. I'd like to tell you that the next 13 years have just been a breeze, but my ego goes from zero to zoom in a very short time. And I started taking some classes. I was going to get real grateful, and take some classes at the community college, and they started to kick in, and I knew I needed to be CEO of something very soon, and that job I'd been very grateful for, now I'm overworked and underpaid, and, geez, when am I going to do it my way? I met him a couple years later, and I thought, oh, my God, it's so efficient. There's a boyfriend and a business partner all rolled into one, and I don't know if I wasn't looking or what, but, in a very short time, the money was gone, and the business was gone, and he was gone, and I was bankrupt, and 10 years over, and I was bankrupt, and you should have heard the wailing. Oh, my God, I was so angry, and all I could hear was Johnny Harris' voice, saying, nobody screams like a thief who's been stolen from, I said, oh. I knew it was in there somehow, and I never could make amends. I could never make it direct amends to my husband, and I got to see in sobriety what it was like to have somebody run through your life like that and have no control, and I got it. I just got it, and maybe that's the only way I'll ever get to make amends that way, but I certainly saw. And I had to pay that money back. I filed bankruptcy, but I knew that, man, he could not have knocked down the house of cards had I not set it up. And the steps, the good news is we're responsible, and the bad news is I'm responsible. I had to get behind people who had, paid money back like that. I didn't know how to do it. So I got a sponsor. I had to get a different sponsor. And every sponsor I've ever had, I'm not one of those people who had the same sponsor for 30 years. It just didn't work out that way for me. It's great if you do, but it's okay if you don't. Every sponsor I've ever had has brought me to the next, And so I got Rita, and she hooked me up with Vince and Pat Y. And our group has a finance class, and I went to that for a while, a financial amends class. And I got on a budget and sort of, made it through. My life got better and different, and I keep going forward. And I've moved a few times, and I've gotten a chance to try a lot of different professions, and I'm not sure if that's good or bad. I mean, I had a job actually for 6 whole years, and that's my claim to fame. The others have been 2 and 3 years, but it seems to work out that way. And I was talking to my boss the other day. I just started this new job back in March, and it sort of takes all of my leftover character defects and uses the best of them, I think. I didn't know that for a little while. I really thought I hated it, but I have to read people's emails, and I have to manage other people's lives, and I have to get up in the morning and go to work and think of the worst that can happen all day, and then run around trying to not let it. So I don't know. I'm hoping it works somehow. But I have a sponsor, still have a sponsor. My sponsor today is Pat Y, and I am a sponsor. And I'll just tell you real quick that my daughter came home to live with me, and I'm a proud grandmother of 2 boys, 11 and 5, and they have never seen the grandma drunk. They love seeing me coming. I have a good time with them, and my daughter's forgiven me for all that stuff. She talks to me.